Chapter 7. We Know Things Now. They manage to slip quickly through the nearest gate as the gates all start closing up on their own. Even the big gashes through the town are going dormant, looking like nothing but earthquake aftermath now. The wolves all shift and dress quickly. Steve goes to Hop, taking Elle from him. The chief is still hobbled on a badly wounded ankle from his Russian prison escape. Eddie has so many questions still. And although Hop doesn't want to let her go, he knows he can't carry her. The light of Max's soul can be seen through Lucas's fingers, but they're not sure how long she'll last outside of a body. They don't want to get stopped by cops or feds, so Eddie hotwires the sheriff Bronco for Hop and one of the other police jeeps, while Hop furrows his brow and says, "Don't teach the kids that." Eddie grins, because if Robin can teach Molotov making, he's definitely gonna teach hotwiring. It's a useful skill, you sure? Hop climbs into the driver's seat, grumbling about no one else driving his truck and damn kids these days, so Eddie takes it as a silent agreement and permission to teach the lot of them, just in case. When they pull into the hospital, Steve leaves Elle in Jonathan and Nancy's care while a miraculously back-from-the-dead Chief Hopper yells for someone to come help him. The rest of the party rushes up to Max's room. When Argyle hears about Johnny Boy being downstairs, he heads off to look for him. Lucas gently lays the ball of light on Max's chest. The light sort of pulses and then syncs up with Max's breathing. Breathe in, bright light, breathe out, dimmed light. It lasts about a minute, and then the ball sort of melts into her chest. They all hold their own breath, and then Eddie feels Max for the first time. Whatever it is that links them all together, he can feel Max on her string now. He lets out a relieved laugh, and Steve takes his hand. Dustin leans into his side, and Mike leans into Dustin. They're all relieved, crying a little. "Well, did it work? I don't speak dog," Erica snaps. Lucas pulls her in tight, nodding, too choked up to say anything. In the bed, Max whimpers but doesn't wake up. It feels like her body wants to shift to repair itself, but it's too broken. "I've got an idea," Dustin says, as he goes to lock the door. "When we fixed Eddie, we laid with him. Maybe she needs us." Steve nods, pulling the IV gently out of her arm and scooping her up, blankets and all. He gently lays her on the floor. "Erica." Someone knocks on the door. "Guys, it's us," Robin calls out. Eddie lets them in. It's Nancy, Robin, Jonathan, Argyle, and Will. The room is way too crowded now, but Eddie locks the door behind them. Strider is coming out of the bathroom as Eddie turns back to the room, so he goes in next, stripping and shifting quickly. Mike, Lucas, and Dustin go in together. Strider lays on one side of Max, Eddie lays next to him. Lucas goes on the other side with Mike and Dustin. They all lay their heads on Max's prone body. "Shift," Strider sends her, and they all feel it. Eddie can hear her mind crying. She's in so much pain. She's so scared. But there's warmth and strength coming from the other wolves, and Eddie has never felt like a family with anyone but Wayne before, but he leans into it gratefully, sending her, "Safe, pack." "Love," Lucas sends as he noses her freckled cheek. "Shift." When she starts to shift, Eddie can feel her scream in his own bones, but she doesn't scream out loud. She shifts fully, and Eddie knows her arms and legs are still broken, that she's still in the dark. Her whimpers probably sound gut-wrenching even to the humans because everyone takes a spot around her. They don't touch her, but they lay their heads and hands on the wolves, lending their strength to the pack. The door unlocks suddenly, and Elle is carried in by Hopper and Joyce. She leaves them at the door, staggering away and quickly dropping to her knees at Max's head. "She needs us." She puts one hand on Max and the other on Strider's head, where it rests across Max's collarbone. "Fine," Erica sighs, rolling her eyes, but sitting down next to Robin, who pulls her in tight. "I better not smell like dog after this, though." It feels like it takes forever. Each bone makes a horrible grinding noise as it grows back together. The scent of copper permeates the air as her freshly stitched surgery scars split open to expel the pins the doctors had put her back together with. After almost too long, Max wakes, shifting to human underneath her blankets and, thankfully, roomy hospital gown, or it would have been torn to shreds. She throws her arms around Lucas first. He's still a wolf, but she doesn't care. She holds him close and cries into his fur. Eddie ducks out to shift first, coming back to scoop Max up and put her back in the bed so everyone has easier access to hugs. There's a pile of casts and bloody metal pins left behind where she'd shifted and healed out of them. Everyone is quick, crying and hugging and taking turns because Max looks exhausted and she's not done healing yet. Elle climbs into bed with her and they hold each other tight. Max whispers, almost like it hurts to speak, "You were there. You fought him. You saved me." Shaking her head, Elle says sadly, "I was there, but I did not save you. I only saved your body. You did not let go when he wanted you to. It gave us the window we needed to beat him." She smiles and her chin trembles. "Because you wanted to live, we all get to live." Looking over at Steve, then at Dustin, Mike, and Lucas, he knows they all felt it. The drag on Max's line, whatever had been haunting her, whatever had allowed Vecna to get into her head, just broke apart and let go of her. She wanted to live. As Max sniffles and cries into Elle's shoulder, they all lean into the person closest to them. Eddie and Steve, Nancy and Robin, Argyle and Jonathan, Erica and Dustin, Will and Mike, Lucas holding Max's hand while Elle holds her. They did it. They made it. All of them. Pretty soon, the nurses and doctors try to push them all out, insisting they leave because this many people is a fire hazard. In all the commotion, Eddie shifts. He's still a wanted criminal, after all. Hop insists that they take Max home, and the hospital isn't sure what to do at first because this shouldn't be possible, but she can walk and see, so they decide they have to let her. Steve signs her out as her brother, and they all leave together. Dustin finds a wheelchair with a wide seat, and Max and Elle squish in together for the trip out to the cars. The two girls spend the next few days sleeping in one of Steve's guest bedrooms, mostly with Max as a lovely red wolf, curled up like an overgrown fox with her head pillowed in either Eleven's lap or Lucas's. Sometimes Will can be found sleeping in there as well. Joyce and Hop gladly take Steve's parents' room, while Nancy and Robin share the other guest bedroom. The boys sleep wherever they can find a free couch or recliner in the house. No one is really picky, they're just glad to all be together. And alive. Eddie keeps sleeping in Steve's bed. Unfortunately, Dustin keeps sleeping on the cot because he can't bear to let Eddie out of his sight yet, insisting daily, "You died!" And yeah, he gets that. But also, he's shared only a handful of kisses with Steve since the cabin, and they keep meeting each other's eyes, and he'd like an hour of uninterrupted time to figure out where they stand. Hopefully really close, with their clothes off. The house is never empty, though. The kids go to their own homes, but never all at once. The Byers Hopper clan still has nowhere to live, so they stay. Joyce apologizes profusely, but Steve insists it's nice to have people in all the rooms. It's just been him for so long. Eddie's heart aches a little at that. Eventually, though, life has to go back to as normal as it can. Hop has already been back to work, taking his badge back while reading the riot act to everyone who can't scurry away fast enough. He holds a town meeting during which he berates the entire town for listening to a child like Jason Carver who didn't know nothing about the real world. He clears Eddie's name. The newspaper prints an anonymous whistleblower article about the son of Victor Creel kidnapping the Byers boy back in 83, killing Barbara Holland, killing Bob Newby, Billy and Heather and her family, burning down Starcourt to hide the bodies of everyone else. Of him coming back this year, killing Chrissy, Patrick, Fred, Jason, and trying to kill Eddie and Max. Of him trying to use the earthquake as cover to kill more people. There's even a ragtag photo that doesn't look at all staged of the full party. All of them, even Joyce and Hopper, filthy and ragged, exhausted but victorious. No one will ever know that Jonathan took it 3 days after they saved the world, and that most of the dirt is actually Hershey's cocoa powder and clearance sale makeup from Melvold's. The town condemns Jason and his friends. Random people start saying hello to Eddie in the grocery store, which has never happened in his life. When he collects Wayne from the motel that the government put him in, they both cry and hug and cry some more. About a week after Vecna's defeat, Max's mom shows up at their door, looking lost and like she's been crying for days. Joyce takes her out back, and they talk for a long time. Steve takes Max aside and tells her she doesn't have to go if she doesn't want to, that she can live here with him, that she's always welcome, that she's his little sister in all the ways that matter. When Max's mom comes back into the house, she holds Max close, apologizing for not being there, for drinking her pain away over the last year. "I felt guilty for all the times I didn't step in and stop Neil from hurting Billy," Mrs. Hargrove sniffles. "I shouldn't have let Neil hit him, but I was afraid for us. And then when Neil left us after Billy's death, I didn't know how I was going to make it work. I've never been alone before." She wipes her eyes with the tops of her knuckles. Reaching forward, Max takes both of her mom's hands in her small ones. "You're not alone, Mom." Her smile is bright and almost joyful, blue eyes full of love in a way that Eddie's never seen from Max. "I'm with you." She sweeps a hand to Steve, Joyce, and everyone else. "And they're with me. You want a family? It's right here." Happy tears spill out over her rosy freckled cheeks, and she hugs her mom tightly. Eddie maybe cries, but he's not alone. He's pretty sure there isn't a dry eye in the house. A few days later, Joyce says over dinner, "I think we should bring the other parents in. They have a right to know what you've all gone through. I'm not sure how legal it is to have an NDA signed by children." Snatching the bowl of mashed potatoes from Lucas's hands, Erica says, "Oh, it's not legal. I looked it up. Our mom is a legal assistant." She plops a spoonful of potatoes on her plate and almost tosses the bowl to Dustin next to her. "Wait, really?" Dustin asks, scooping potatoes onto his own plate. "Nope. The federal age of adult is 18. So, in the eyes of the government, we are all minors and not old enough to understand the legal ramifications of a contract. Therefore, any contract signed by a minor is null and void, even if we've turned 18 since." She says the whole thing while she's slapping a pat of butter and some salt on her potatoes, and then looks around the table and grins proudly. "Okay, so I think we bring all of your parents in, and you kids can tell them what happened. As long as Hop, Eddie, and I stay out of it, we're not breaking our contracts," Joyce says, shrugging. "I never signed an NDA," Eddie says. "The government hasn't contacted me yet. I don't think they know where to find me." "Even better," Joyce replies. They meet at the cabin, because it's the only place they can guarantee isn't bugged by the feds. They bring ice chests and lawn chairs and picnic blankets. The Sinclairs, the Wheelers, Claudia Henderson, Uncle Wayne, Max's mom, and all of the party. Holly gets left with a babysitter because Nancy says she can't keep a secret yet, especially not one with doggies. Hop gets up, stands in the little clearing that the kids have dubbed the stage, and thanks them all for coming. "You're going to hear some things today that you won't like, things that will scare you. But I hope you also hear how brave your kids are, how strong, how grown up. We're going to take turns telling the story because we weren't all together when parts of it happened." He looks at Will, who gets up from where he's sprawled out on a blanket with Elle and Max, and walks over to Hop shyly. It starts with Will. He claps a hand on the kid's shoulder and then limps back to his seat. Will stutters, but then takes a steadying breath. "Back in 1983, I wasn't kidnapped. I was riding my bike home, and I heard something and fell off my bike. When I looked up, there was a monster there. Later, we would call it the Demogorgon. I ran through the woods to my house, but it followed me. When it came inside, I ran out back to the shed, and through the shed," he takes a deep, steadying breath. "I crawled through an opening into another dimension. Later, we would call it the Upside Down." For Eddie, some parts of this is going to be new information. He's heard bits and pieces, but there wasn't time for a full rundown beginning to end. So, this is the first time he's hearing from Will what happened to him. They're going as close to chronologically as possible, so Will stops talking and looks to Steve and Nancy, who get up together. Eddie's in a lawn chair with Steve sitting on the ground in front of him. He squeezes Eddie's knee briefly as he gets up, dusting off his jeans. Eddie takes the opportunity to check out his ass. It's a great ass. At the time, Steve and I were dating. The night after Will went missing, I went to a party at Steve's house with a few of his friends and took Barb with me. Barbara Holland. Nancy's voice trembles a little, and Steve takes her hand. Eddie falls just a little further for him because he's just like that. Kind. We were drinking, and Barb cut her hand. I wasn't a nice person at the time, so I didn't do any of the things I would do now. Dress the wound, get her home safely. Steve glances over at Eddie, who smiles gently at him, before Steve looks back at their parents. At the Wheelers. We were young and dumb and immortal, or so we thought. Instead, I invited Nancy upstairs for dry clothes. And the way he says dry clothes insinuates exactly what he intends. And I went, Nancy declares defiantly, chin pointed up. Because I was young and dumb and thought I was immortal. She looks at Steve with a sad fondness. But also, we were just kids, just 16 and 17 and a little in love. Excuse me, what am I hearing? Mr. Wheeler cuts in, sputtering and confused, but his wife cuts him off with a shh and a whisper about already knowing and let them talk. He grumbles, but settles back down in his folded lawn chair. Nancy clears her throat. So, Steve and I went upstairs, and while we were indisposed, Barb didn't go home like she said she was going to. She sat on the diving board, dangling her feet in the pool, blood dripping into the water from the cut on her hand. How do you know she sat there like that? Mrs. Sinclair asks shrewdly, and Eddie is absolutely positive that Erica gets her sharp mind from this woman. Jonathan stands up now, on the other side of Nancy. He takes her free hand with his opposite, leaving the one next to her to drape across her shoulders and cup Steve's shoulder in support. That's where I come in. I was wandering around the woods, looking for evidence of Will. I heard screaming and laughter and went to check it out. Steve's backyard opens right into the woods, no fence. By the time I got there, everyone had gone in, except Barb, who was alone on the diving board. I took pictures because that's just what I do. I was distracted, though, didn't see the monster in the frame because Nancy was standing at a window upstairs and she took off her shirt. He looked sheepish, and they'd already decided not to go into more detail about that. When I looked back at the pool, Barb was gone. The next day, Nancy says, cutting off several of the parents' comments, I came back to look for Barb in the woods, because she never made it home and her car was still parked down the street from Steve's. In the woods, I saw the Demogorgon. Later, when Jonathan developed the photos, we would see the Demogorgon behind her at the pool. Much later, we would learn that it dragged her into the Upside Down and killed her. She turns to Jonathan and presses her forehead against his throat. She's still holding Steve's hand, so he puts his arms around her too. The tableau of the three of them standing there is meaningful, shows the parents that what they've been through together trumps the sting of teenage breakups. Dustin, Mike, and Lucas get up next and explain about finding a girl in the woods when they were out searching for Will, about how she didn't talk and she didn't know how to do things or what normal behavior was. She was like an alien, Lucas says, and he and Elle grin at each other. They explain all about Eleven and how they hid her in Mike's basement the entire time Will was missing. Eddie slides his hand over the arm of his chair and dangles it near Elle. She takes it, smiling up at him with that way she has of smiling with her chin. Karen Wheeler is shocked. Mr. Wheeler looks confused. He keeps looking at Hopper like he's waiting for a punchline. Eleven gets up with the boys and makes a rock float before she flings it into the woods with her mind. After the parents settle down from freaking out, the story goes on through all the events of 1983, dipping into how Eleven came to be and what happened at Hawkins' lab. Well, what they know about it, at least. Some of it is still news to Eddie. He's not shocked like the parents are, but there's still a surprising amount of what the fuck. Most of the Demodog stuff in 1984 is stuff that Eddie has heard, but once again, it wasn't in any semblance of order when he heard it. Hearing it as close to chronological as they can get it is much better. Much more cohesive. When they get to the part where Billy showed up, Max steps out and looks at the Sinclairs with determination and sorrow. My stepbrother used his home life as an excuse to let him be a bad person. Maybe if he'd had friends like these, he'd have chosen to be better. But he wasn't. He didn't like Lucas because of his skin color, and he'd threatened me about him several times. When he showed up at the Byers house, if Steve hadn't been there, I don't know what would have happened. Her voice cracks. Max is tough. She's always tough. But it's obvious that admitting these things is painful, that she feels responsible for them. We faced monsters, and the scariest thing in all that time wasn't a monster. It was a person, a boy, my brother. Later, he would be the thing that saved us, but it came too late. She drags in her next breath so harshly that Eddie winces. And I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry he treated Lucas like that. Mrs. Sinclair gets up quickly and envelops Max in a hug, smoothing her hand down Max's back. No, sweetie, you don't need to apologize for him or people like him. People will always have small minds, hateful minds. But you're something good in this world, and you don't have to carry their deeds on your back. Max nods, sniffling, wiping quickly at the tears on her cheeks. Mrs. Sinclair gives her another squeeze before she returns to her family. Lucas steps away from the group, taking Max's hand in his, touching their shoulders together. When Billy showed up, Steve went out to talk to him. He knocked Steve down when his back was turned and came into the house. He grabbed me by my throat and threw me against the wall, yelling at me to stay away from his sister. Lucas's voice doesn't waver, but his mom starts to cry, leaning into her husband and holding tightly to Erica, who looks angry enough to bring Billy back to life just so she can kill him again. Steve came into the house, Mike takes over. He pulled Billy off of Lucas and threw him across the room. Steve's plenty strong, but Billy was something else. Scary. He was on steroids, Eddie informs them from his chair. Reefer Rick was sidelining steroids to a bunch of the jocks. Coke, too. Steve's standing up with the kids and throws his hands up in surrender. Not me. I got my ass kicked. If I'd been on steroids, maybe I would have landed punches that actually hurt him. Mike laughs a little. It's okay, Steve. You protected us. We're just sorry we weren't strong enough yet to protect you. A fond look passes between them. Wheeler loves to fuck with Steve, but when it comes right down to it, they're family. Eddie gets all smushy inside again. Gross. Mike turns back to look at the parents. Billy grabbed a plate, a heavy one, and smashed it against Steve's head, and then he wrestled them to the floor and just punched him over and over. Max grabbed one of the drug needles meant for Will and buried it in Billy's neck. It worked pretty quick, and he was on his ass. Dustin, language, his mom says, glancing out of the corner of her eye to the other parents. Rolling his eyes because they all know she lets him cuss, Dustin continues. Then Max threatened him with the bat. He passed out. We all grabbed face masks and bandanas and goggles and headed out to do the plan we'd been fighting over. Steve was unconscious, concussed actually, so we hauled him out to Billy's Camaro and Max drove us to the farm with the tunnel opening. Max drove? Her mom asks, shocked. Not well, Steve answers. Scariest ride of my life, let me tell you. I'll be teaching the little maverick to drive when she's 16, thank you. Max swats at his arm. I did great. We all made it there in one piece. Well, not you, but you didn't start in one piece, so that's not my fault. Steve flicks her in the forehead, and she sticks her tongue out. They go into detail about the tunnels and the plan. Al and Hop tell their version of the lab. Nancy, Jonathan, and Joyce tell their version of the cabin with Will and the mind flayer. When it gets to the part where they have to explain the after effects of the Demodog pollen, or whatever it was, Steve tells them to go change, and he tells the parents a more detailed version of the same story he'd told Eddie in the old boathouse. Except with the added detail that that night in his sleep, Steve had shifted, probably because he was injured, that he woke up as something else, that later, once he'd calmed down, he felt the kids as well, had gone running around town to collect each of them and brought them to his house to figure out how to shift back. Just before sunrise, he'd driven them all home wearing old t-shirts and sweats. That was when they decided to leave spare clothes at Steve's for everyone. You too, Steve. Go shift, Eddie goads, because he loves to see them all together. Steve jogs over to the door to the cabin, pulling off his shirt just before he slips through the door. He did that on purpose. What a tease. I like it when Steve takes his shirt off, Elle admits calmly. Hopper groans, running his hand down his face and grumbling. Not appropriate. Why not? I do. Max does too, and before she can out Will or Eddie for checking out Steve, Robin cuts in. She's a smart girl. Gross. That's my best friend you're talking about, and I do not want to think about you kids ogling his hairy chest. Ew. She turns up her nose and dramatically flops into Eddie's lap, dangling her long legs over the side of the chair like a drunk baby giraffe. Her head tips back over the arm, and Elle boops her nose, making them both laugh before Robin sits up and rests her head on Eddie's shoulder. Just then, there's a series of yips from the house, and Strider bounds over with his gaggle of puppies. He sits in the middle of the clearing proudly, while each wolf goes to their parents. The red wolf to Mrs. Mayfield. She's dropped the Hargrove and gone back to sharing a name with Max, thankfully. Mrs. Mayfield at first looks nervous, but then she sees Max's bright blue eyes and she coos, laughing gently as Max licks her cheek. Dustin literally frolics over to his mom, rubbing his way all around her chair and almost climbing into her lap. She throws her hands up at first and then says, "Is this my Dusty? Oh my goodness." His tail wags like a dog's, and Eddie can't help but bury his face in Robin's hair as he grins way too wide. Lucas thunders over to his family, with paws that get bigger every time he shifts. Erica screeches and tries to get away. "No, don't you dare lick me, Lucas Charles Sinclair, or so help me." He licks her cheek and she shrieks again. Once Lucas settles down, his dad pats his head, more than a little unsure. "We like it. You can pet him," Eddie tells them. "We?" Mrs. Sinclair asks, scratching behind one of Lucas's ears as he tilts his head into it. "I'm a shapeshifter too, but that comes later. In 1986. We're not to that part of the story yet," Eddie answers, as he nudges Robin out of his lap. "She's not light. They're only like 2 inches apart in height." She gets off, but doesn't go far, sitting against the leg Steve wasn't. Eddie tugs on her hair, and she elbows him in the shin. Leaving his mom, Dustin goes over to Wayne, who's been silent for most of the story. He'd been there for the practice run of it at Steve's last night. He noses against Wayne's cheek, and Wayne looks at him fondly, petting along the side of his neck. He sees the wolves at Steve's all the time, and he and Dustin have become quite close, opposites though they are. Mike doesn't bound over to his family. He creeps close to his mom, tail low behind him, and then lays down with his head on his paws. Very gently, she reaches out and pets his nose. He inches a little closer. She pets his head. He gets a little closer, until he lays his head in her lap. "Oh, Michael, is this why you've been so cuddly these last few years?" Mr. Wheeler scowls, and Eddie wants to slap him. "I wish I'd brought Holly, but she could never keep a secret." She smiles brightly, eyes a little shiny, scratching along Mike's back. Nancy nods. "Someday, when she's older." Mr. Wheeler reaches out and pets the top of Mike's head, and when Mike sort of tilts into it, he scratches behind Mike's ears. "You should sit on the couch instead of your recliner when you watch TV, Mr. Wheeler. They really love to just lay on the couch and get head scratches," Robin says, looking first at Mike and then at Strider, who seems to smile at her, knows exactly what she's doing. Mr. Wheeler seems to think about it, nods, and goes back to scratching Mike's ears. Eddie gives her hair a very gentle tug and whispers, "That was a very nice thing you just did, Birdie." She doesn't reply, but he can see the side of her smile. "It's like having a dog you don't have to clean up after," she tells Ted Wheeler cheerfully, giving Eddie the side eye to see if he's offended by being called a dog. He is. Tugging on her hair a little harder, Eddie tells her, "I take it back. You're awful." She grins, satisfied. The wolves all go back to Strider, who's sitting up in the middle of their clearing area. They lay around him in a dog pile of sorts, and he noses at each of their heads. Forever the babysitter, Eddie thinks fondly. He also thinks that he has to do something about all this mush he's feeling.
"I think it was me," Will says from where he's leaning against Elle. "I've never heard the story like that, and I think I was still connected to the hive mind when the pollen started changing you all on the inside. The Mind Flayer had most of the control, but now that we know what I can do, I think I probably sensed you guys in the hive mind while you were probably still in the tunnels. I think I subconsciously created a back door, a separate path. Then, when Steve shifted that night, he made a choice." "Will Byers, you'll make a great DM, letting your players pick their own path like that," Eddie teases him, but he's so proud of them both. Will, for being so good that even possessed by a monster, he was saving his friends. And Steve, for deciding all those years ago to go apologize to Jonathan Byers and change the course of his own life. And to keep changing it. Strider lightly steps over the pile of wolves around him, going over to Will, nosing at the side of Will's face as Will squeaks and bends away from him, and Strider chortles. He goes for Elle next, rubbing his cheek against hers. She cups his wolf face in her hands, touching their foreheads together and breathing him in. "You are good, Steve. Thank you for saving our friends." And because he's a wolf, Steve can't brush it off. He can't deny it like he normally would. He just ducks his head, but lets her hold on to him. Eddie claps his hands loudly, startling everyone. Then he grins maniacally. "All right, kids, puppy time is over. Go shift, because I'm ready to hear about the Russians, finally." They all prance around to parents, licking cheeks and getting a few more pets. Eddie watches them and completely misses the sneak attack he gets from Strider, who almost climbs into his lap and licks his face, nosing his ears and tickling his hair, Eddie shrieking in indignation, "You asshole!" Strider does his chuff laugh, racing away with all the kids. He's lucky he's cute. Robin is laughing so hard she falls over on the blanket she laid out for her and Steve. Nancy laughs into her hand, and Jonathan chuckles pretty hard too. Joyce has a big grin on her face. While they wait, Joyce and Nancy and Mrs. Wheeler make sure everyone has a fresh drink. They pass around bags of chips and a plate of cookies that Mrs. Henderson made. Eddie takes three, passing one to Robin, asking, "Where are your parents, Buckley?" "Oh, I'm 18 already, and if my parents found out about this, they probably wouldn't let me out of the house. I'm hoping to just piggyback with whatever happens with the NDAs. Me and Steve both." She sighs sadly, biting into her cookie only to sigh again, but this time pornographically. Eddie snorts, and she covers her face in embarrassment. When the wolves come back out as their human versions, Steve flops down next to Robin. Eddie hands him one of the two remaining cookies, and Steve smiles fondly as he takes it. He also makes a noise that borders on pornographic, and Eddie has to close his eyes for a moment and remind himself that someday he'll get more than 5 minutes alone with Steve. Nancy gets up with Jonathan, and they tell the story about the rats and the crazy old lady, about Heather and Billy Hargrove. Erica stands up. "Okay, this is the part where I come in, and Mom, Dad, it's gonna sound bad, but we made it out, and I got free ice cream for life out of it." Robin and Steve both burst into laughter, falling into each other like idiots. Erica turns to them and says, "For life." Shaking his head, Dustin says, "Erica, geez." Then he gets up, and the two of them tell the story about the underground Russian base. When he gets to the part where they were separated, Robin takes over. Because Steve was concussed again and can't be trusted to remember anything, apparently. When she describes Steve getting hit over and over, and the Russians taking out the torture tools, drugging them both up and going for Steve again, Eddie can't help himself. He has to hold on to Steve's shoulder. He knew the guy was a tank, but does he have to take all the hits? Steve reaches up and gently pats his hand. Everyone tells their parts as they're all happening at the same time like usual. And then they all end up at the Star Court together at the end with Billy and the meat monster, which is a disgusting terminology, and Eddie hates it with a passion. He's also a bit sad he can never use the term in one of his campaigns. Rip cool monster names. All of them except for Dustin and Erica, who were at the radio tower, and Joyce, Murray, and Hopper, who were under the mall in the base and had no idea what was happening up top. At one point, Lucas bursts into song. "Turn around, look at what you see." The rest of the kids jump in. Actually, jump. From wherever they're sitting, they jump up, circling each other and singing, spinning with their arms out like they're flying. All grinning like idiots, singing slightly off key. Except Dustin, who is stone-faced until the end and then just says, "I hate you guys." Once that is explained, Mrs. Sinclair leans into her husband, pulling Erica close. Mr. Sinclair pats his wife's hand, and Erica grumbles about constantly being put in the safest positions, and they don't need to get upset. Right up until she gets that look from her mom. That look sort of looks like the one Erica gives the rest of them, so Eddie's glad he got to watch her on the receiving end of it. He almost cackles. He doesn't. because now he's scared of two Sinclair women, but it's close. The end of this one is hard. Mrs. Mayfield cries, and Max comforts her, swears that Billy saved them all in the end. Karen Wheeler cries too, then she says the most shocking shit ever. "It was me who told Billy where to find you guys at the Byers. He was so polite, said he was just worried about his sister. I didn't know. She puts her face in her hands and cries silently for a few seconds and then says, "And last summer at the pool, he propositioned me, asked if I wanted private swim lessons, but I said no. What if I'd said yes? That would have been me, a meat monster, and maybe the kids too, Holly." She starts to sob, and Nancy and Mike rush over. "Mom, take it from me. You can't play the what-if game. It will tear you apart. It will ruin relationships and destroy what you do have." Nancy squeezes her mom's hand and looks over at Steve before looking back at her mom. "We've probably all come closer to death than we realize over the past few years. It's part of the reason we're bringing you guys in. We need you to understand what we're going through." "Why we have nightmares," Dustin says, leaning his head on his mom's knee, but looking at Eddie. "Why we pull away," Max says quietly, looking at Steve before she looks up at her mom. "Why we think we're badass and don't listen to our parents," Elle chirps, like she's repeating something Hop said. He confirms it by letting out a gruff laugh and running a hand over his head before he pulls her in for a hug. The rest of the kids all laugh too. Erica points to her and says, "That." This time, Eddie does cackle. He loves these fucking kids. They move on, talking about losing Hop and the Byers moving to California. Then they get into Eddie's story, so he taps Robin and Steve on their heads. "Move it, chuckleheads, my turn in the spotlight." And, of course, he can't just tell the story. He has to set it up first, give it a little showmanship. But then he gets to Chrissy's death and feels like he's about to cry. Steve and Robin reach out for his hand at the same time, and they have a three-way hand-holding session. It gives him the strength to continue. He tells them about how Vecna killed her, in detail, because that's what they've been doing with everything, but it's hard to describe her silent death. He admits that he'd freaked out and run away. Nancy tells them about meeting Wayne with his story about Victor Creel, about Fred dying. They talk about Max and Dustin demanding they find Eddie because he was innocent, about breaking into the school to look at Chrissy's records, Nancy and Robin visiting Victor Creel, Max admitting that she was next. For this part, she gets up and sits next to Steve. He puts his arm around her, and she leans in. She admits that she blamed herself for Billy. Her mom cries silently. Max does too. Joyce goes over to Mrs. Mayfield and lets her lean on Joyce's small shoulder. Lucas takes over, tells the story of the graveyard, about Max floating in the air, too high for even Steve to reach, about the song that saved her, a song about swapping places. Eddie feels Steve's shoulders shake and realizes that he's crying too. He presses his leg into Steve's side for comfort, grounding, thinks he gets it. When Eddie talks about Patrick, he doesn't get up, sort of just curls into the chair instead. When he talks about Steve jumping into the lake, he does get up. Pacing back and forth, he says, "And then Steve just dove into the water, swam down to a gate to a hell dimension like it was no big deal. One of the vines followed him up through the water, though, and while he was still telling us about the gate, it yanked him down." He wants to light a cigarette so bad, but he doesn't want the parents to think he's a bad influence, so he just spins his rings instead. And then Wheeler, freaking Wheeler. He looks over at her and shakes his head. She just dives right in after him like the badass she is. Then Robin, too, so I had to follow. Couldn't let the girls show me up. And when we swim down, up, to the other side, to a hell dimension, Steve's being strangled and eaten by huge bats with three tails and skin like leather. Eddie tugs on his hair, tells the rest of the story of hiking through the upside down, with Steve half-eaten, shirtless and shoeless. "I bet he looked bitchin' though, right?" Elle says, with guileless hearts in her eyes. "You bet your ass he did," Eddie confirms, pointing at her in agreement, and Steve groans for them both to shut up. Hopper also groans for them both to shut up. Mike grumbles darkly, and Max just cackles. He can see the realization on a few of the parents' faces as they figure out that Eddie isn't joking, that he, like Elle and Max, also likes it when Steve takes off his shirt. For a moment, he's freaked out about that, but then he decides he doesn't care. They've faced so much. He's a fucking shapeshifter. If they're okay with that, but not okay that he might be falling in love with Steve Harrington, they can jump in the quarry. But Joyce Byers, she says, "Oh." Meeting Eddie's eyes and then looking at Will and back at Eddie with a small smile. On his way back to his seat, she pulls him in for a hug. When she leans back, she cups his cheeks and says, "I love you." He can only nod and bite his lips together to stop himself from sobbing, because 12-year-old him really needed a mom like Joyce. Nancy gets up next, pulling attention away from him thankfully, tells them about her vision. They are justly cowed, and hopefully prioritizing the end of the world over who kisses who, they remember the dark smoke and the red lightning, the huge fissures in the earth of Hawkins. Elle tells them who Henry/1/Vecna was, and his role at the lab. Being reminded of the destruction and how close they came to the end of the world takes the sting out of the rest of the story. About using Max as bait, about letting Erica play a part that got her assaulted by a jock, about Max dying and Elle bringing her back from half a country away, about Eddie dying and Steve bringing him back as a shapeshifter. Wayne smiles at that part. Do we get to see? Even though he's seen it plenty at Steve's house. Eddie pulls his rings off, handing them over to Steve for safekeeping, and then he skips over to the house because he's ridiculous. Inside, he strips quickly, leaving his clothes in a pile near the couch, and then lopes down the stairs and over to the group. The most metal-looking wolf in this pack. "Hey, kid," Wayne says in his gruff voice, putting a hand out for Eddie to nuzzle into. Eddie huffs against Wayne's scratchy 5 o'clock somewhere shadow, and then he prances over to the kids, bumping into them, licking cheeks and nuzzling into necks. Max is still curled up with Steve, so Eddie goes in to bump his nose against her and fakes out to lick across Steve's face instead before dancing away with chuffing laughter. Steve yelps, but then says, "I guess I deserved that." "Yeah, you did," Robin points at him, laughing until Eddie races back to lick the side of her face from jaw to temple, too. "Oh, gross, Eddie, what the hell?" She pushes him away and he goes, running back toward the cabin to get changed. "So, how come you're not all werewolves?" Argyle asks as Eddie is plopping back down in his chair and taking back the rings. He sounds like he's just putting everything together, or like his high is wearing off. "Like, all of you were in the creepy upside down, right?" Dustin perks up. "I've got a theory on that." He jumps up because he's dramatic as hell. "So, when we were all in the tunnels, the air was thick with that pollen. There were vines everywhere and a bunch of those flowers. I think it was a breeding ground." "No," Mike interrupts, and Dustin looks shocked. But Mike's not disagreeing with his theory because he continues, "Can you not say the word breeding? Gross. Just say we got a concentrated dose or something, man." "Fine." Dustin throws up his hands. "We got a concentrated dose, meant for breeding." Mike whispers something about Dustin being an asshole. "But I think whatever it was, a little bit of it might be in everyone who was in the upside down. Like, our DNA has been changed." He looks excited about it. "You think that's how Steve changed me? I already carried the marker or whatever for being a wolf," Eddie asks, thinking, not for the first time, about how he could have just as easily woken up as a demodog. Dustin shrugs. "I think we should get a powerful microscope and look at our DNA compared to the unchanged members of the party who were in the upside down but not in the tunnels, like Nancy or Robin. Like in biology when they made us swab the inside of our cheeks and look at it," Steve asks. And the slight confusion in his voice, even though it's the right answer, is so damn cute that Eddie wants to kiss him. Dustin points to him. "Exactly." "Awesome." Steve smiles, then in a deadpan, "I nominate you for that." Dustin grins, but then his eyebrow furrows when he realizes he's just been given extra work. Eddie has to pinch his own leg to keep himself from kissing Steve for that setup. Grumbling as he sits back down, Dustin says, "I wanted to do it anyway." Hopper and Joyce tell the story of Russia. It's obvious that Hopper downplays the 9 months he spent as a prisoner, but no one calls him out on it. For almost all of them, it's the first they've heard the full details, and, as a group, they agree that Joyce Byers is the original badass. The final battle story makes them all sound pretty badass, though. The Sinclairs are very grateful that Steve made Erica go watch Max and stay out of trouble. They're less enthused about Lucas's being involved, but all of the parents understand just how seasoned their warrior children are at this point. Lucas gets to be the one to tell the story of carrying Max's soul back to her body, like Peter Pan carrying Tinkerbell back to Neverland or something. He cries when he describes them all sending her strength to help her shift and heal, even the humans, even Erica. Max goes back to her mom then, putting her arms around her mother and holding her while they both cry. After a few moments of silence to let the full weight of the last 3 years sink in, Nancy stands up again. She's got this look about her, the one she gets when she's raising her shotgun in a fight. "Mrs. Sinclair," she says, shoulders set, "I'd like your help with the real final battle, the United States government." End of chapter 7.